Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's wonderful to be back in Pennsylvania, and it's wonderful to fool the pundits, because we're going to win the state of Pennsylvania. We're going to win it on November 4th.
At least John McCain hopes he's fooling the pundits and the pollsters. The AP poll out this morning shows Barack Obama leading Pennsylvania by 12 points, with just 8% still undecided. The AP has Obama leading in 6 of the 8 swinging swing states and tied in the other 2. Our first guest today is Democratic strategist Bob Schrum, author of No Excuses, Concessions of a Serial Campaigner. He's a columnist for The Week magazine now and a senior fellow at NYU's Wagner School of Public Service. He did strategy for John Kerry's presidential race, among many, many other campaigns. Hi, Bob. Welcome back to WNYC.
Hi. Happy to be here.
You know what I've been wondering? People always call the show and say, I've got a great idea for my candidate. Why doesn't he name his top cabinet members right now? And that powerhouse team will wow all the voters down the stretch. But they never, ever do it. Why don't they do that?
Well, you're right. Of course, it's a perennial idea. And people think it's some people have such great enthusiasm for it, they think it's original. Well, Bush half did it in 2000. I mean, he sort of, you know, by first he picked Cheney, then he sort of let the word out there that Colin Powell was almost certainly going to be Secretary of State. And that was to make up, I think, for any sense people might have that he didn't have the necessary background. He was reassuring people that his father's team of moderate Republicans would be there. Of course, that's not how it turned out. I think people don't do it because, in the end, voters actually vote for the president, and to a much lesser extent, the vice president. They don't vote for some prospective list of cabinet officials. And secondly, it would almost look like a sign of weakness to do it.
Sign of weakness. And I guess you give the media and the other side a whole list of other individuals with all their baggage, because everybody has some baggage, you know, to start poking at.
Sure. I mean, you know, just think of how many people would suddenly be vetted. You'd be reading stories about everybody. Who did they work for? Who were their clients in the past? What did they set in their lives? I mean, all of which comes up in confirmation hearings. But let's just say
but
you're
Obama.
That's
after the election. Go ahead.
Right. Let's just say you're Obama. What do you want people thinking about right now? What your prospective Secretary of Defense did when he was in business 5 years ago, or the economy?
I hear you. Now, assuming for the moment an Obama victory, who do you think some of his top cabinet members might be, especially with the recession and the financial crisis, or I guess not technically a recession yet, but, you know, the economy, financial crisis? Who might he pick for Treasury Secretary or even Secretary of Labor under circumstances like these?
Well, first of all, I don't know anything. Now, that's never stopped a pundit from talking. So
at least to recognize that.
Look, the names that are most talked about for Treasury are two people who've been there before, Bob Rubin and Larry Summers, and two people who haven't been there before but have deep experience in the kinds of issues that have to be dealt with here, Governor John Corzine of New Jersey and Timothy Geithner, who's the head of the Federal Reserve Board in New York. But I have no idea whether that's Obama's list. I don't think anybody can know. I do believe that he will have some Republicans. I would not be surprised to see Colin Powell in the administration. I think it's possible that the current Secretary of Defense, Gates, would stay in the administration. I think it's possible that Chuck Hagel, the retiring Republican senator from Nebraska, would be part of the Obama team.
You think he means it about bipartisanship?
Yes.
On the Treasury Secretary, you know, there's a debate now taking place in progressive circles over whether Obama should rule out anybody from Wall Street. We got Paulson from Wall Street, helped get us into this mess. Going back to Clinton, Robert Rubin helped, you know, fan the flames of all the current economic stuff at its roots. And so people say, look, it should be someone like Joseph Stiglitz or someone else from academic economics, so they don't have the taint and the corrupted mindset of Wall Street. Think that'll be actually discussed in circles of power if Obama is elected?
Well, the first thing I want to say is I want to defend some of these folks. I've been accused at times of being too populist or too progressive. As a political consultant, was assailed for Gore's slogan, "The People, Not the Powerful," in 2004. Bob Rubin is a person who genuinely cares about social justice and economic justice. And the fact that he knows how Wall Street works is probably an asset, not a liability. John Corzine has been one of the most progressive governors of New Jersey in a very, very difficult period of time. The fact that he was once CEO of Goldman Sachs tells us that he knows, Goldman Sachs, by the way, probably the premier brand on Wall Street, tells us that he knows how these markets work. But what you really want to know are what people's values are, number one, and then if they have the right values, do they know what they're doing? The last thing I think that Victoria's Democratic Party needs to do, especially one led by Obama, who's talking about unity and bringing people together, is say, listen, if you were in the business community, you just have no place in the government.
My guest on WNYC, longtime Democratic strategist Bob Schrum. And here we are just 6 days before the election. The McCain campaign has been using taxes as its central argument since Joe the Plumber and the final debate. And we'll play a Palin clip in a minute on that note and an Obama defense. But today I understand they will reintroduce the military and national security experience argument, started to do it yesterday actually in Fayetteville, to add to the closing attempt to raise doubts about Obama. What do you expect to hear on that, and how far do you expect them to take it?
Well, it's no surprise. I mean, the closing argument was supposedly the one we were hearing 2 days ago, but the Obama campaign, the McCain campaign just jumps from one tactic to another. And I think, you know, they get up this morning and yesterday and they look at the L.A. Times Bloomberg poll, which shows them losing Ohio by 9, losing Florida by 7, and they say, gee, we ought to go out and try something else. So they're going to go back to the national security argument. The national security argument was settled in the first debate. People looked at Obama standing next to McCain. They said, he can do the job. He's got enough experience. He can be commander-in-chief. You know, we've had this three times in modern history in our politics. We had this with Ronald Reagan and Jimmy Carter, and Carter said, Reagan's inexperienced, can't do the job. We had it with Richard Nixon and John Kennedy. He said, Kennedy's inexperienced, can't do the job. The first Bush said the same thing about Bill Clinton. Guess what? All three times, the so-called inexperienced candidate has won.
Right, and I think that's really the main reason that Bush tapped Colin Powell or signaled that he'd appoint Colin Powell early on, maybe to, you know, indicate some moderation because of Powell's race or, I don't know, something, as you were indicating before, but I think also to shore up the military chops, because Bush was coming out of, you know, governor of Texas and didn't have any of that kind of experience. But we might certainly there's that history, and we might think that this is an old argument now. But I thought the same thing when I saw Hillary Clinton's Red Telephone 3 a.m. commercial. Remember that? Released for the weekend before the Texas primary. I thought, oh, they've had this, you know, experience versus judgment on the Iraq vote and all that debate for 9 months, but it worked. So
well,
why wouldn't it close?
First of all, it worked in the popular vote in Texas by a very small margin.
I know he won the delegates.
Even in the popular vote, a very small margin in a state that was heavily skewed in her favor in terms of Hispanic votes. So I wouldn't draw large conclusions about what's going to happen this week out of that.
All right. What do you think about all this U.S. military activity right now in Pakistan, repeatedly across the border? Even in Syria, might we still, even at this late date, be in for some kind of situation that ratchets up national security anxieties, perhaps even coordinated with the Bush administration, if that's not too much of a conspiracy theory?
Well, I think that might be too much of a conspiracy theory. I think there might be some resistance, actually, in the Pentagon to being used in that way. And I think there'd be resistance from Gates to having the Army used in that way. But I also if you really wanted to do this, I don't know if you could calculate the effect of one of these episodes. I mean, for example, the Osama bin Laden tape, which came out the Friday before the election in 2004, probably cost John Kerry the elections. The tape where, essence, Osama bin Laden told people to vote against Bush, which he knew was going to have precisely the opposite effect. I think if something like that happened again, people would draw back and say, wait a minute, we're not going down this road a second time. So I think it's very difficult if you were actually trying to decide what incident you could have that would exert a big impact on the election, to identify it and to know precisely what that impact would be.
What else, then? It's not going to just peter out between now and Tuesday like the Dole campaign in 96 when he was obviously losing, is it?
No, and the press, you know, the press really, you know, I mean, the press is going to go through this and say, well, here's this possibility and this might happen and that might happen because it's the story. I had someone from one of the networks say to me yesterday, what are we going to do on election night if Obama wins Virginia or Obama wins North Carolina or probably much less likely Obama wins Indiana? We know at that point that the election's over, but we can't tell anybody because most of the country still has to vote.
Yeah, they'll tell people, right? They will. No, I mean, we're starting our election coverage Tuesday night at 7, even for our New York audience, when the polls close here at 9, New Jersey at 8, because we know it closes at 7 in Virginia. We know it closes at 7 in Indiana. Most of Florida closes at 7. If those things come in early for Obama, it could be over at 7:45.
Yes, but you can't say that.
Well, you can. I guess I just did. But so what else between now and then? Over the weekend, ugly robocalls, tightening polls, sensationalized by the press. Anything you anticipate?
I think that there will be a lot of ugly robocalls. I think there will be the press running a lot of stories about could McCain come back, but also you're beginning to see a lot of stories on what really happened to McCain and what's the future of the Republican Party. So there's a kind of schizophrenic reaction in the press.
I mean, you've been through enough of those stories after Democratic Party losses.
Yeah, but usually it's after we lose.
That's what I was going to say. This usually starts after the election.
But those were very, very close elections. I mean, look, I think Al Gore won. He just got elected and not inaugurated. And John Kerry of about half a football field in Ohio had changed their minds. Or maybe if the votes had been more accurately counted and cast in Ohio, he might have been president. So, but going into those elections, it was a 1 or 2 point race either way. Here, that's not the situation. And, you know, you have Romney, for example, saying today there's a very real possibility of an Obama presidency. So the postmortems are beginning while the patient is still on the gurney.
The McCain endgame has been very much about taxes. We will play a clip of Sarah Palin on the stump yesterday, then Obama responding to this line of attack.
Now, you have to really listen to our opponent's words through all of this. Listen to what he's saying, because now he had been hiding behind his real agenda of redistributing your hard-earned money. He says that he's for a tax credit, which is when government takes more of your money and gives it away to someone else according to a politician's priorities. Now, that's as opposed to John McCain, who is for a real tax cut, which means when government takes less of your earnings in the first place. Yes.
If you make less than $250,000 a year, how many make less than $250,000 a year? Raise your hand. Actually, it's just about everybody here, but you want to keep your hands in your pocket. It's too cold. If you make less than $250,000 a year, and that includes, by the way, 98% of small businesses and 99.9% of plumbers, you will not see your taxes increase one single dime. Not your payroll tax, not your capital gains tax, not your income tax. No tax, because the last thing you need is higher taxes when we're in a recession like this, and you won't get one under an Obama administration.
All right. So tomorrow we'll have fact checker Bill Adair, and we'll check some of those claims like that McCain doesn't have an earned income tax credit in his plan, or Obama's claim that 98% of small businesses make under $250,000. But it's a very 1980 Reagan emphasis from the Republicans, and that's what your column is about this week and in the week. But I guess they think that it has eternal relevance.
Well, look, the Reagan dispensation lasted a long time, basically 28 years. You could argue that it began to run out of steam 3 or 4 years ago, didn't do very well in 2006. The tactic was to always invoke the word liberal, claim that someone was raising your taxes when almost invariably it wasn't your taxes, it was taxes of a relatively small number of people at the top.
Right, but there is something about that, that I want to mention for a second and get your reaction to it, which is that maybe uniquely in this country, voters understand that more than maybe you were implying and tend to vote for the economic policy that is good for the class or the income bracket that they aspire to rather than the one that they're in, because so many Americans still believe in the possibility of their own personal social mobility. Do you agree?
I don't think most Americans think they're going to make over $250,000 a year. I mean, the average income in this country is about $45,000 or $46,000, number one. Number two, if they get to that $250,000 point, they can worry about it then, and they don't think it's going to happen in the next 2 or 3 years.
But that was exactly the Joe the plumber argument. I mean, that guy's argument, Joe,
he
was just a plumber now making $40,000, whatever it was, but that he hopes to someday own his small business, and then $250,000 is a realistic goal.
You know what people hope for right now? They hope to keep their houses. They hope to keep their jobs. They hope they can get student loans to send their kids back to school, and they hope somebody's going to do something about health care. And all this talk about socialism, sharing the wealth, spreading the wealth instead of creating wealth, which is ironic, by the way, coming from people who presided over the greatest destruction of wealth in human history, it just goes right over folks' head. I mean, I've listened to this stuff long enough, and I've decided that I'm going to call a lot of what's being said lies because that's what they are. When Sarah Palin says he's going to tax your money and take away your money, that's a lie. Maybe she doesn't know it. Maybe they just handed her the script. When she says John McCain doesn't believe in tax credits and Barack Obama does, that's just a lie. John McCain has voted for tax credits. And you know what? I think voters are actually getting it. They're not listening to this sort of old, tired rhetoric that comes out of the Reagan era, that worked for a long time, powered the 94 Gingrich Revolution, was at the heart of Bush's economic policy, and the country's tired of it, and it wants to move on. We're moving into a post-Reagan era in the sense that we're no longer going to be believers in wholesale deregulation and redistribution of income toward the top.
Bob Schrum, Democratic strategist for a long, long time, columnist for The Week. Before you go, what was your favorite campaign to work on ever?
Oh, I liked an awful lot of them. I mean, there was the Kennedy campaign in 1980. You know, Senator Kennedy became and remains one of my closest friends. So that's certainly a favorite campaign. But look, I was very proud to work for Al Gore in 2000, John Kerry in 2004. One got elected, not inaugurated, as I said. The other came very, very close. So it'd be tough for me to pick just one.
And if Obama wins, what happens the next day?
I think the country feels really good about itself.
What do they do the next day?
The Obama people?
Yeah.
They have to begin to put together an administration. Somebody says, can we have the transition team please bring in the books and the papers they prepared? And by the way, the McCain campaign's doing the same thing. There's nothing presumptuous about having a transition team get ready in case you win.
Right. I mean, Obama gets credit for running such a good campaign. But
I think the best campaign I've seen in a very, very long time.
But we had David Brooks here the other day, and he said, I asked him, is this really over? The polls are starting to look like it's really over. And he said it was really over 9 months ago because people generally vote on the basis of party. And the economic conditions and the unpopularity of other stuff that Bush has done so favors the Democrat right now that basically it was over 9 months ago when the two nominations were sealed. Do you disagree?
I think it's not over unless the people who support Obama actually show up at the polls. So I want to say that. But the fundamental conditions of this election have favored Obama for a long time. McCain was wrong when he said the fundamentals of the economy are strong, but the fundamentals of politics are strong for Obama.
Yeah, I know you say he's run a great campaign, and he has run such a good campaign. When you watch Fox News, they constantly talk about how Obama has gotten a pass from the media. They dropped the Reverend Wright thing without really asking why he stayed in that church for 20 years, they say. Didn't push the Resco thing or the Acorn thing very far. Let him leave public financing without hammering that gigantic flip-flop that had that a Republican would have been seen as,
the voters
a traitor
could
for.
The less of a hoot about public financing. That's why no one's pushing it.
As it turns out. And Obama has put his foot in his mouth big time in a few instances. The bitter people who cling to their guns and religion has haunted him for 6 months. Now this remark to Joe the plumber about using his taxes to spread the wealth.
He never said, I want to use your taxes to spread the wealth.
But Joe's complaint was about taxes.
He said, we've reached the point in America. Look, we just went through a period of relative economic growth under Bush in which middle class incomes actually were stagnant and in many cases declined. That's what he means by spread the wealth, that we have to create more of the wealth, but we have to make sure that some of it gets to the middle class, too.
That's where we leave it with Bob Schramm, columnist for the week, former longtime Democratic strategist, and author of, you want to say the book title?
Sure, No Excuses, Concessions of a Serial Campaigner.
Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up in a minute, we will track the Dow a little bit on the day after its 900-point jump, little bit up so far today, but talk about what this may or may not really mean with New York Times economics columnist David Leonhardt. Stay tuned.